Good morning and welcome to Overstock.com's special conference call regarding the lawsuit that was filed on their behalf yesterday in the Superior Court of California. My name is Philip, and I will be your conference moderator. Dr. Patrick Byrne, Overstock.com President and CEO, will be today's speaker. A web-based slide presentation will be used during the call and is available for download or viewing over the Internet on the company website, www.shareholder.com/Overstock. If you are listening via telephone and want to view the presentation via the Internet, please select the No Audio Slides option. If you select the regular webcast, you may experience up to a 25-second delay. For assistance at any time during the call, please press star zero. This call is being recorded and will be available for replay beginning today at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time through 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time, Friday, August 19th. The replay can be accessed by dialing 888-203-1112 and entering the access code of 419-9807. The webcast will also be available for replay via the company's website. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Byrne. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Philip. Good morning. I want to first state that with this, I'm getting out of the business of dealing with shorts, fighting shorts, talking about shorts. And hand the baton over to a group of very qualified lawyers. I'm not planning on being in this job forever. And you know I want to operate a certain way while I'm in it. And now I want to get something off my chest and in the record and inform others can make use of it, because I think there are others in the same situation. I believe Overstock has been damaged. And our damage model supports a number in the high hundreds of millions of dollars, perhaps more. We filed a lawsuit to recover those damages from Messrs. Rocker, Cahotes, Don Vickery, Carbettis, and others. I do think the trail leads farther, much farther, and I think that many more of the names of the people who come up are going to be highly recognizable. I also want to say I'm a value guy to my toes, and I could not be more indifferent to my stock price. I agree that CEOs who spend time worrying about shorts or obsessing about shorts are fools, and that most of the CEOs who tangle with shorts are crooks. I think shorting plays a healthy role in a normal market, but I'm going to describe a set of events, and I think that the reasonable listener is going to say, you know, if that's really what's going on, you're right to do something about it. As a matter of fact, yesterday, one of our major institutional owners visited us. I wasn't even prepared, and he dropped in, and before I could even say anything, he said, I love that you're standing up to this crowd. It's out of control, but they're getting away with what they're doing, and we can't believe the regulators aren't doing something, and it's time we go to the regulators. That from one of our top institutions. So I don't buy that everybody's out there saying, oh, you're just supposed to keep taking this. And he did not even know the story I'm going to tell you. I hope the listeners may remember the Predator's Ball of the 1980s, and Bungalow 9 and all that. I'm calling this story, and I'm going to tell you, the Miscreant's Ball. Now, this is a picture of our market participant volume. This is a picture of our volume in the marketplace since we went public, as reported by the market participants. Fair enough. You see it going up to about 30 million there to spike. This is interesting. This shows, stand by just a moment. Oh, by the way, the market participant volume is as is Autex reported, which is a voluntary reporting system by BDs. Okay, this picture shows the volume that actually takes place in the marketplace. And as you can see, there's, well, for the first 6 or 7 months after we went public, these numbers line up. But then there's a divergence. That's pretty odd, and we've shown this to some smart people, including the NASD, who cannot really explain it. And I don't pretend to be an expert, but there are two explanations, two hypotheses, I can suggest. One is, and again, I'm not claiming anything for certain. I'm just one explanation is if somebody wanted to create froth and spoofing in our stock, and a whole bunch of phony volume that wasn't really, unreal volume, how they could do that is use a broker-dealer. And by the way, these numbers don't necessarily have to line up. Again, it's the difference between what's electronically reported in a captured in a market and what's voluntarily reported by broker-dealers. So the two don't have to line up, and there normally is going to be some discrepancy. But normally broker-dealers they want to claim more volume than they actually do. Or if, Goldman sells a million IBM to somebody, Morgan Stanley, both sides are going to claim the million, and that's why you get, you get double counting. But this is odd, because in some months you see that the amount of excess is actually over 100% of the amount that's reported. So what that seems to mean is that there are some broker-dealers who have volume who are not reporting it. Well, one way that could happen is if, for example, a hedge fund had a couple offshore accounts and had a broker-dealer in the British Virgin Islands or something who was traded it back and forth among themselves to create volume. That's one way it could happen. Another way it could happen, I think, is if there was somebody naked short. Most of these hedge funds are now set up with a master feeder account over both domestic and offshore. So even if your money is in the domestic account, it flows through offshore, and the accounting gets done offshore. And each of those onshore and offshore accounts are going to have their own prime brokers, and usually two or three. So imagine there were somebody, hypothetically, who's naked short, and they've got, say, Morgan Stanley, and I really am just picking names, out of thin air. Morgan Stanley saying, hey, look, we told you got to cover that short, you got to cover this short. The guy says, sure, don't worry. And he, you've got to cover those fails in your account. The guy says, sure, don't worry. And he goes to a different fund offshore and sells short from that fund to cover the Morgan Stanley fails. So now he's just moved the fails to another account at another prime brokerage. And so if, for example, people were getting serious about Reg Show, which is what I'm starting to hear, and the brokers were starting to put that kind of pressure on their clients, the clients could just move the fail around among different accounts and through different prime brokerages. And if they also were doing that through, say, some BVI broker-dealer, that would, who didn't want the trading, didn't want to be associated with the trading or for it to be traceable to him, could be doing that trading without reporting it. And that's why you would get this 100% discrepancy. So, for example, in January of this year, and I know, by the way, these slides are small, if you see them on the screen, but you can download this, when the call's over, you can download this PowerPoint and view this in more detail. There's, in January of this year, there's the widest gap. There's a 30 million share gap between what was reported by the BDs and the what was the marketplace volume? 30 million shares. It's 28 versus 58 million. So that was incidentally the month that we went on the Reg Show list for the first time, and our security traded what looked quite odd to me that month. Could just be a coincidence, and I am sincerely saying, I'm just giving you two hypotheses. I'm going to talk about Bob O'Brien for a bit. Bob O'Brien contacted me through a letter shortly after the October conference call where I asked David Brock on the phone. And I acknowledged that the guy sounded like he lined his hat with tinfoil. He sounded crazy. But he's laid out this scheme that I'm not going to go into again that has to do with naked shorting between bad hedge funds and the offshore foreign exchanges and the deposits at the DTCC without necessarily say that DTCC knows what's going on. But he laid out this whole scheme that sounded kind of crazy. And it included And if you want to understand it, of course, you can go to my blog, or you can go to the transcript of that October conference call, October 2004, and read about it. Well, part of his conspiracy theory, so to speak, was that there was a smoke screen produced by certain folks in the financial media and stock research firms and paid message board posters and planners attorneys that kept the public from seeing what was going on behind the curtain. Well, I dismissed O'Brien, and I did, but I remember that before I did, or as I did, he said, look, just watch for four things. And he made these four predictions, that Herb Greenberg, Barron, that now that I had gotten into it with David Rocker publicly, he said that you're going to have half the jobs done on you by Herb Greenberg, Barron's Wall Street Journal, Camelback, Camel Home, Liz McDonald, or Forbes. They'd call and they would do half the jobs. That Overstock would appear on numerous foreign exchanges. That we would show up on the Reg Show threshold list when it started in January. And that we'd be the target of federal investigation. Well, those are four pretty strange predictions that got made to me in I think, the first few days of November. And within 3 days, all the specific individuals he had named had called me, and you know, within a week they were published half a job. I think Liz McDonald took a couple weeks. We did appear over the next couple months on Stuttgart, Munich, Frankfurt, Berlin, ex-Australia, and extra. And we appeared on the Reg Show list on January 27th. That's pretty strange. The power of any theory is its ability to make predictions. It doesn't matter how wacky a theory sounds. If it makes predictions that are confirmed, you've got to pay attention to it. Federal investigation. I'm only going to mention in passing that we didn't become the object of a FTC investigation, but I in no way associate that with this. Folks at the FTC were right. We had slipped a stitch in a couple ways, and they were right to bring it to our attention, so I'm in no way associating that, and it is public that we had an FTC, I'm no way associating that with this. But we did in February become the object of an informal inquiry from the SEC. I'm not supposed to know about that, but this rumor reached me virtually simultaneously from two different sources, one anonymous. And now I figured that it turns out you don't have a duty to report an informal investigation. If that's true, you certainly don't have a duty to report a rumor of an informal investigation. But there was some 30 or 60-day informal investigation, I understand, of us by the SEC, sort of a fishing trip, and nothing ever came of it. We were never alerted to it. So again, those are, the power, you have to judge a theory, no matter how wacky, by its predictive power. And I'd say that it scored highly. Now I'm going to talk about, I'll call the not necessarily miscreant's fall. And in this, that theory, those events I just described got me very interested in the relationship between just got me interested in the hedge fund industry in general. And I want to talk about the hedge fund industry and some folks in it and relationships without specifically trying to say that any of these folks are bad. I want to talk about some of the relationships. In fact, I'm going to stipulate that I'm not saying these folks have done anything wrong or illegal. In fact, so here's a box. I'm going to put some hedge fund folks. I'm going to put all the miscreants in the box marked miscreant hedge funds, and there's their naked shorting thing going on beneath the line. And I'm stipulating that that line separates improper activity from people who are not engaged in any improper activity. But I just want to talk about some relationships. These are the folks I'm going to talk about. Now, David Rocker and Mark Pote, as you know. David Einhorn and Leon Black. I put in there just because he's a well-known financier, hedge fund guy. Got nothing to say about him. Sort of putting him in as an example of just somebody in a hedge fund. Not everybody in this game is crooked. So I'm stipulating that I'm not saying anything about alleging any illegal activity about folks above the line. So I put that line in there to sort of separate the bad guys from the acceptable guys. Now, David Einhorn runs a fund in New York called Greenlight Capital. Greenlight, I've been in Greenlight, and they told me sort of the founding myth of Greenlight, which was David Einhorn, was a Cornell guy who found some arb and traded it from his dorm room, and you know that turned into Greenlight over time. Rocker and Cahotes are, of course, partners. Tom Barton and Jim Carruthers are ex-Feshback guys from the 1980s. Hopefully we all remember that. But the days of the 1980s and Feshback, a good, honorable firm. Tom Barton's down in Texas now. Jim Carruthers is an interesting fellow. He's up at Eastbourne Capital, north of San Francisco. Eastbourne has an E at the end. It's funny because there's a fellow holding himself out in a nearby location by the name of Jim Carruthers, with a slightly different spelling, holding himself out as a private investigator from Eastbourne Investigations, no E at the end. I know that couldn't be this Jim Carruthers because that would be a felony for a person to hold himself out as a PI when he's not. And that PI has a very interesting relationship with a certain lawyer in Detroit who has some very odd practices that maybe we'll have time to get back to. Other people that bear mentioning, Kevin Ingram. Kevin Ingram was a prominent fellow in the late 1990s in Wall Street. He left Wall Street, started a .com, I think it was crashing. He got caught attempting to sell Stinger missiles, or obtain Stinger missiles, for some Pakistani ISI agents who turned out to be undercover feds. In fact, he agreed to work on obtaining a nuclear trigger for them. But then so he went to the pen for a few years. He's out now, and he's basically a gopher for some of these folks. Then there's Milberg Weiss, which is a fine, upstanding law firm, good members of the bar in California, plaintiff's attorney firm. And you don't have to do much digging, and this is all publicly available documents, but I think they are an amazing law firm because they're extraordinarily prescient in certain matters and in their lawsuits, and they come in at very opportune times, generally within a few days or after or before the filing of SEC investigations, certain articles from Streak.com, Herb Greenberg, and CBS MarketWatch. So very prescient and a law firm that's on the balls of feet. Now, David Rocker owns two offshore funds. Runs two offshore funds, Helmsman and Compass. And through them, he owns a plurality stake in the Street.com, which has graduated not only such journalistic luminaries as Jim Cramer, but Herb Greenberg, Jeff Matthews, and Jesse Eisinger. Now, Herb Greenberg, the followers of our story, we'll know that Herb, we'll recognize Herb as the guy who, I think he's written about 35 negative articles last year on NFI. This was a David Rocker short, and which he's publicly acknowledged being short. And I don't know how many articles on us. I finally wrote Herb, and I said, Herb, is this some subtle way of approaching me? It's okay if it is, but I'm just not into that. It's okay. He just seemed obsessed with me. Well, oddly enough, he stopped in February, more or less stopped, writing about me. And the same week practically that he stopped, a blog was created by Jeff Matthews, who runs a RAM Partners. And in my view, I think the assignment got passed from Herb to Jeff. And in fact, here's a nice indication of Jeff's work. It's actually surprisingly smooth. Catherine Huang, our treasurer, remember, left. I mentioned that on our last conference call. So this is a letter he wrote to her shortly afterward, basically trying to get, recruit her. interesting, what's interesting to me is not only how smooth this is, but how I doubt it's his first, and it's actually quite sophisticated and bears all the hallmarks of a good recruitment. And I hope you download the PowerPoint later and take a chance to read that more closely. Then there's Camelback. Now, Camelback was described to me when I first wrote a nasty report. I mean, I think they've written 58 now or something. But when they first wrote something negative on me, I got a call from a friend at a hedge fund in New York, and yes, I have them. Hey, by the way, my brother runs a hedge fund, so I'm not down on hedge funds per se. But somebody called me and said, look, don't worry about Camelback. This is who they are. This is how it works. We pay them $25,000 a year, and for $25,000, you get to pick up the phone twice a year and order a hatchet job on whatever company you want to, and they do it. I mentioned that once in a conference call, and Don Vickery at Camelback got irate with me, sent me a letter, said, no, the price is $40 now. So, well, there's more to it than that, though. There's more to it than just that. What it turns out they do at Camelback is they do a number of interesting things. Not only will they take your order for a hatchet job, but they'll actually write the research and supply it to that requesting client beforehand and let out. My understanding is that that's not such a kosher thing for a research firm to do, to supply one of its clients' research for others. But they do more than that. In the case with David Rocker, what they've done, and by the way, there's a guy named Don Vickery at Camelback, and he sits there and he talks 3 or 4 times a week to Herb Greenberg and to Rocker, and in our case, coordinated attacks on us. And in our case, he not only supplied the research on a prior basis to David Rocker, supplied it and allowed David Rocker to essentially edit it. And it demanded on certain things being inserted and grades being changed, so on and so forth. In addition, David Rocker was able to request of these characters, I'm sure Herb as well, because David has admitted talking to Herb a lot, but we've got some people who've been part of all this, by the way, who've given us full detail on it. Mr. Rocker was able to say, this is fine, it's ready to publish, hold it off for a few days, I need to build my position, and Camelback and Herb obliged him. Jesse Eisinger, I'll get back to in a minute. Oh, by the way, before I go on, there's something else Camelback seems to be doing, and that is in the past they've been running money out of Camelback under the name of Pinnacle Fund. There's even a fellow, so that's a little odd that people in a research firm would also be running money, and there was actually a fellow at one desk answering one telephone, Camelback Research, and the other telephone on his desk, Pinnacle. In fact, the positions, at least at one point in that Pinnacle Fund, bore a curious resemblance to some of the companies that Camelback was writing about. I turned this information, in case you're listening, folks at Camelback, I turned that information over to the state regulators back earlier this year, and I noticed that about 10 days later, you sold and hastily moved Pinnacle out of your offices. I just wanted you to know where that came from. Elizabeth McDonald with Forbes, for all I know, she's fine. And I should emphasize that I don't know, I understand that there can be a very healthy relationship between shorts and reporters. You know, reporters are not, the SEC is undermanned, and reporters are in general not up to the task of the detailed forensic work that needs to be done to sort of deconstruct a bad company. So I agree there can be a healthy relationship, and for all I know, that's what Elizabeth McDonald is part of. Carol Ramon from Dow Jones, she's a French journalist. French immigrant. Here I've worked for Dow Jones. I'll get back to her in a minute. Then there's Barron's. And Barron's, anybody on the street understands Barron's more or less is just being a group of quislings for the hedge funds. There's one reporter there I respect, a guy named Jack Willoughby, but from what I can tell, the rest are just mouthpieces for the hedge funds. So, for example, there's been until recently an editor there named Cheryl Strauss, married named Cheryl Strauss Einhorn, wife of David Einhorn. And if you trace the articles around, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, you'll see that, again, there are these very odd relationships. Let me tell you a couple interesting stories. Oh, actually, before I do, I'm going to go on with. Oh, there's a line connecting Jesse Eisenberg and Carol Ramone. This is Elliot Spitzer. I'm not putting him up here, of course, because I think there's anything inappropriate about him. I just wanted to remind folks for them that don't know that he's a close friend of Jim Cramer. They went to law school together. Elliot Spitzer put his family money with Cramer Berkowitz when he wanted public service. According to the Wall Street Journal, his major donors are the hedge funds. And in fact, there was a story last year that said there was a hedge fund fundraising dinner for him where the word on everybody's lips was, you know, are we next? From hedge funds, and the signals given basically no. After the insurance companies, we've got other plans. I have an idea who those other plans are, but not. One more. Kroll. Kroll's been investigating me for a number of months, trying to come up with dirt on me. The general I had trouble nailing that down until I discovered the personal relationship between Jules Kroll and David Einhorn. And then I'll just fill in a couple more squares. All the SEC, I've told you that they were pushed to start an informal investigation on me back in, that started in February. And the DOJ. Now, the DOJ is Department of Justice, I think, is a lot different than the SEC. It doesn't, but the way these folks work, if they have their druthers, is there are some hedge funds, believe it or not, who are very politically connected investors, say from Texas and Chicago. And the basic pattern seems to be that Kroll develops dirt on a company, and it gets turned into a white paper, and somebody, a politically connected investor, and one of the hedge funds calls up the SEC or the DOJ and says, hey, you know, listen, I was just having breakfast with George and Laura. They send their regards. And by the way, I know a guy on Wall Street who's come across something you really need to take a look at. And so then one of the hedge funds goes in, sends somebody in with this white paper, and they try to get an investigation started. That's how the basic system works. DOJ my understanding is, and I don't know this for a fact, my understanding is that was tried in May about me, and that some people tried, turned up that I do travel to strange parts of the world, Saudi Arabia and Iran and places like that, and somebody just, you know, it's very easy to get people's credit card records, and I'm open about it anyway. And if they turned that into a white paper that said Burns tied up with Al-Qaeda and terrorism and money laundering, and you got to look at this guy. And that it was essentially laughed, my understanding is, that was just laughed out of the office at the Department of Justice. But so, and I think that there are much more independent commands, and I think that, for example, the SEC is a much more independent and immune from political pressure. So we don't need to criticize anyone there. A couple stories I'd like to share before we move on. One is, this has gotten fairly ugly in the last 6 months or so. So, for example, there is a guy named David Patch, who's a strange guy. I mean, David Patch and O'Brien, there's a voice crying in the wilderness syndrome, where they're the only guys out there in the wilderness crying, and no one listens, and they get strange. But Patch started seeing pictures of his wife, or himself posted on a message board, and his wife's social security number and his own social security number, sort of low-level thuggery to show, or a picture of his house, low-level thuggery to show, you know, we're watching you. Same thing started, happening with O'Brien. O'Brien worked with this woman, Mary Halbrin, who's a lovely 69-year-old woman, who's actually our co-plaintiff. and Mary takes care of a nephew who was in a motorcycle crash and had a head injury. And so there started to be messages posted from Mike Helburn, Mike the Vegetable Helburn, with, you know, my thought for the day, grrr. And Mary has a sister who passed away a few years ago, Leanne. And so there started to be postings from Leanne Helburn, you know, wish you were here, Mary. Favorite activity, if you look at her profile, was rocking, things like that. So it got a little much. So O'Brien did something he shouldn't, and I told him he shouldn't have done this, or I thought he shouldn't have done this. O'Brien, now there's been this long public fight on the message boards that I don't have a position in, but the public fight was between O'Brien and these bashers who seem professionally, they seem to have make a living out of bashing. And it's because it's public. I can say that O'Brien has been accusing them publicly on these message boards of being paid for by Cotes, and of course they're denying it. And that was back and forth on Yahoo. So after they put these messages up about this woman, Mary, O'Brien basically said, two can play at this game. And he posted Cotes' home address. Now that was a dumb thing to do. And he knows it was dumb. And actually apologized. And if you ever want to see a classy apology, go and look at his website. It was not one of these apologies that says, oh, I was wrong, but just, you know, you guys are the church. He wrote a really nice public apology. All that said, he didn't mention Cotes' name. And yet, within a few minutes of him posting this address, some folks on Yahoo immediately recognized it as Cotes' address. Well, that's a little bit odd. But they immediately, because it didn't say Cotes, but they immediately notified Yahoo, and there was this kind of stuff going on, and they cut off O'Brien. That's interesting, but what's really interesting is an article got written about it, and the article got written by somebody who left out everything about, the David Patch having pictures of himself and his wife and the house posted up on the on a message board that didn't fly, we're watching you. You know, literally like a picture taken in a parking lot was posted up just to sort of send a message. They left out everything about Mary and what had been posted about her, and they just mentioned that they just wrote it as if O'Brien had threatened Mark Cotes, which was completely false. And that article was published where else? In Barron's. And I forget the author's name for the moment, but I'm sure if you dug, you would quickly see that there was a relationship between him and Cheryl Strauss-Einhold. They knew each other. Well, at that point, things got very interesting, and Jesse Eisinger was given the assignment to basically track down O'Brien. But I think it was more than that. He actually he found me out in a conference I was in. I refused to talk to him without a tape recorder on, because I've dealt with a journal before, and there's just a bunch of dishonest reporters. Over and over, they'll play this trick, by the way, where they say, I will only talk to a Wall Street Journal reporter with a phone on, because they're such crooks. And, with a tape recorder on. And literally, I've had them do that, and then afterwards say, write me a little email that said, oh, my tape recorder turns out to have been broken, but don't worry, I took good notes. Well, they've done this once to a friend of mine, and they did it once to me, so now I only talk to them with a tape recorder on. But Jesse really wasn't doing an interview. He was there to show me that he had obtained my banking records. He had obtained records of two wires I set, or a few wires. He didn't even have all the records. But of some wires I had set to this sent to this organization, NCANS, to pay for, an ad in the Washington Post and stuff. Now, I've been public about that. I don't know why it was such a big deal. I've been public. Yes, I paid for that. I largely wrote the ad, or 50% more wrote the ad. But it was really, as far as I could tell, and I had some two other folks there listening, was basically to show me, hey, we've got access to your wire information in O'Brien's. Something else funny happened. My phone went dead, and a message came up in Spanish that said this has been diverted to some telephone companies in Mexico, and the line was out. The same hour that happened, see, they got a hold of O'Brien's cell phone records. They got a hold of O'Brien's cell phone records, and they started calling everywhere O'Brien had called. And I know this sounds like a John Grisham novel, but bear with me. They started calling everywhere he had called. So, for example, there's a woman who sees a psychiatrist who has a patient's only telephone number. That number started getting called. Who was doing the calling? Jesse Eisinger from the Wall Street Journal. Some lawyers, O'Brien had called a guy they think is O'Brien's brother, who has some alcoholic problems and sort of easily set off. They were literally calling six times an hour at one point. That was Jesse Eisinger from the Wall Street Journal. Same with, there was an elderly lady in Las Vegas that was just picking up the phone, Jesse Eisinger, hanging up over and over and over, harassing her. Jesse eventually flew to Las Vegas and trespassed within a gated community and would not leave this woman's porch, hoping, you know, trying to get her to confirm that she was Bob O'Brien's mother. So the neighbors seized him, and they called the police, and the police arrested him. And they cited him, and evidently had a tantrum on the porch and was screaming, you know, this is bullshit. I'm a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. But the police cited him in this community in Las Vegas. So although the Wall Street Journal received a couple dozen letters, and they responded, always standing by the reporter, eventually it got a little, you know, too unseemly even for the Wall Street Journal to have a reporter running around with banking records that could only have been feloniously obtained and harassing 70-year-old ladies. So somebody pulled the leash on Jesse after about 3 weeks of this. And what was funny about that is literally the hour they pulled the leash on him, after 3 weeks of pursuing the story and calling and calling and calling people, after 3 weeks of that, he stopped. He stopped cold one hour, and the next hour, Sara Ramon started calling all the same people and doing the same thing, calling the mother, the putative mother, the brother, calling everybody who had been called from that cell phone. That's the kind of behavior we're up against. And now, so I just, again, think Jesse Eisinger was given an assignment by somebody in the hedge fund community to track down O'Brien, and then when he had his leash pulled, it was passed to Carol Ramon. Of course, these are personal opinions that I'm forming, and these are my beliefs. I don't know that for a fact. Just about everything I'm telling you is, in fact, a matter of personal opinion. And, you know, I believe this stuff. Can't say it for certain. I should have that halo over this entire presentation with a couple exceptions. Now, what's the purpose of all this? I believe there's been a plan since we were in our teens. To destroy our stock, drive it down to $6 to $10, and you see at the bottom of the sheet there, it says bottom tier. There's a designated final owner who was to end up owning our company at the $6 to $10 range, and even a plan for how the company would then get whacked up among if he could do a hostile takeover and take it private, and how the company could be whacked up among a group of people who had participated. Hedge funds we participated, not necessarily any of the ones I'm showing you here. I don't know. And here's the funny part. As this went on, I started realizing and that there was actually some more orchestration here being provided by a fellow I'm calling here the Sith Lord, or the Mastermind. Now, can I tell you who that designated bottom feeder was who's supposed to have ended up with our company? Can I tell you? I can, but I'm not going to today. The Sith Lord is, can I tell you who that is? Well, I could tell you it's a name that everybody on the phone, every single person on the phone, would recognize this person's name. He's one of the master criminals from the 1980s, and he's back in business, but I'm not going to, well, I'll just call him the Mastermind today. So that's the system. Now, people may say, Byrne, you're being paranoid and whatever, but before I go on short sellers, I did want to mention David Einhorn and David Rocker, that David Einhorn is the guy who's, of course, obsessive about his concern. Literally, they told me in Greenlight how he's got six cell phones and slot SIM cards and takes a different route to work. And I mean, I was in Greenlight. They were explaining how I couldn't even go into this part of the office and see him. He's extremely shy and careful, won't be seen in public, have pictures taken, anything like that. So if you ever see this man in public, do not take his picture. because he's evidently extremely concerned about it being known or out there on the internet. Then there's, of course, David Rocker. I just thought it'd be interesting to leave those pictures up there. Okay. Now, a different line. The SEC promulgated Reddit show. And by the way, I can do without the phone call saying, Burn, how can you be criticizing the SEC? Don't you think I know that it's crazy to be out? Do you think it's, I don't know it's crazy to be out here criticizing the SEC? Yeah, I know that. I'm also know I'm a U.S. citizen. I got a First Amendment right to criticize the government. I never signed that away. And these guys aren't doing the jobs. Regulations show, if you go on the SEC.gov page and go into the FAQs, you'll see two interesting, well, you can find these two, this language in there. I'm going to read you, I've added emphasis to the line that says the grandfathering at the bottom sentence of the first section. Grandfathering provisions of regulation show were adopted because the commission was concerned about creating volatility where there were large pre-existing open positions. Well, so that's for that reason on January 3rd, they grandfathered the, when they set the threshold, they grandfathered the amount of failures to deliver that already existed. So I've been saying, okay, don't tell me, you know, I think that that shouldn't be the case. I think that you should, that they shouldn't grandfather it. But go ahead and just tell us the size of the fail. Tell us the size of the fail. I don't need to know who did it, what broker did it, what client did it. Just let the market work. Be transparent and show the size of the fails, and then the market can operate. Their answer to that, first of all, to say that some investors have requested that the SROs provide more detailed information, including the total number of fails, the names of the customers and the responsible brokers. Well, I don't really care about the names of the customers and broker-dealers. They say the fail statistics of individual firms and customers is proprietary information and may reflect firms' trading strategies. The release of this information could be used to engage in unlawful upward manipulation of the price of the securities in order to squeeze the firm improperly. So, now this is where I feel like I'm missing something. I'm hearing, a year and a half ago, if you go back a year and a half ago, they were saying that this wasn't a problem. And they've gone from saying it's not a problem to saying, well, we've got a grandfather of the problem and we can't tell you the full extent of the, we can't tell you the size of the number of fails because otherwise it would create volatility and reveal the trading strategy of the criminals who are doing the naked shorting. So, in the words of Wayne and Garth, squeezing, what am I missing here? You guys didn't become government regulators, I think, to do things like this. And I think that you've got to know that. You've got to look at this and you've got to know, folks at the SEC, this is not what you became a government regulator to do. So now I'm going to go, given that set of facts, I'm going to go very briefly through a few of the slides I showed a week ago because I've got feedback that some people didn't get what I'm talking about. Look, this is the short position. These are the days to cover. 6.5 million short. Our volume, who knows what our legitimate volume is. It may be a fraction of what's been reported if there is a bunch of spoofing going on. But there's a 14-day days to cover, last I calculated. There are 18.7 million shares now issued in the marketplace, 6.5 million short, and naked short of 0.1 to whatever. You now know everything I do. I put guesses down of 1 to 5 million. I don't know if those first couple slides I showed you with discrepancies of up to 30 million between the reported volume and the marketplace volume affect this number or not. I got no idea, and for the reason I just showed you, I can't find out. The SEC will not release that information or direct the SROs to. So I have no idea how many shares of our company are trading, but my reasonable guess has come to 25 or 30 million shares. And then I showed this slide, which shows what I own, my father owns, what other people in the Byrne family own. Now, those are guesses, and that's why I have brackets in there, what the top 10 institutions own and what close friends or friends own. Or, as I said, people I took baths with. Oh, I got to get back to that. By the way, Carol Ramone had something stuck in her craw about the fact, and most people, I think, understood that when I said folks I took baths with, to mean, like, you know, my cousins and brothers and things, whatever, old girlfriend. She's calling around and saying that Byrne has a gay bathhouse cabal, and that's where this has been organized. There's something about the whole bath references esteemed Carol. My theory is it's because she's French. But, and so 300,000 shares are seen, in my mind, to be available in the world, and there's 7 to 12 million that are actually, that the world thinks they own. I want to go back a bit, because I forgot to tell you a bit about Kroll, how I tracked down Kroll. I've had the feeling, I've been seeing things that suggested in a very mild way, somebody was intercepting communications. Now, I'm going to tell a story that I'm not sure that this part was Kroll, but the way I tested that was I came up with one channel, channel A, I'll call, and I put information down there that I was gay. And channel B, I put information down that I was a coquette. Now, my apologies to my gay friends, both within and without, outside the company. I don't mean to equate the two. I don't care. I'm a libertarian, and I don't care at all. In fact, I don't give a hoot if anybody thinks I'm gay. But I thought that by putting that information down one channel and putting the coquette information down another channel, I would then know if it leaked into the world that those channels were compromised. And I know there's no way that information, I know that if that ever appeared, it could only have come from channel A or channel B, and I didn't even mix the channels. Sure enough, within a short time, I started seeing on the message boards, oh, Byrne, you know, Byrne is gay, whatever. Again, nothing decisive, but it was enough to pique my interest. On the cokehead thing, and by the way, with one exception, I've never even seen cocaine in my life, so in case you're wondering, no, I'm not a cokehead. My former professor, a thesis advisor of mine from Stanford, got a phone call from a private investigator posing as an investor, saying that she was doing due diligence on Patrick Byrne and wanted to know about me, and did he know me well? And by the way, had Byrne been into coke when I was in Stanford? So, again, nothing decisive, but something that tells me, that suggests that channel's compromised. That's when I got eager to find out I got eager to pin that down. When I found that Jules Kroll and David Einhorn have, I believe, a relationship, I try to, you know, Kroll is a large corporate investigation service that bought a couple $1 billion by Marsh Mack some years ago. A bunch of retired brass, really, from the Bureau. So, of course, they won't tell you if they're investigating you. And so eventually what I did, I had some fun about 6 weeks ago. I just called them and said, I'd like to come in and hire you. My thinking was that they couldn't let me hire them. They couldn't even sign an NDA with me if they were, in fact, investigating with me. And of course, they couldn't tell me I can't come in and see them because that would also confirm. So the head of the office called me back very quickly, and he said, why do you want to talk to us? Is this about naked shorting? Because I've been reading about what you've been saying in the papers, Mr. Byrne. So I said, no, this is about, I'm going to Venezuela, I'm going to need some bodyguards. Well, there's no way he'd really say no. And he's a fine guy. I mean, I don't envy him. I went into Sam, and he met me, brought a witness, and my guess is he was taping it. He's a former prosecutor. And it was really kind of an odd meeting, because I knew that they couldn't let me hire them. But I also knew that they couldn't tell me that. So I spent the meeting sort of, you know, building a little bit of rapport and then saying, oh, by the way, can we sign an NDA? And he says, yeah, we can probably dig up an NDA somewhere around here. I could get someone to write one up. But could you first tell us a little bit more? And I just sort of kept bringing up, so I would let it pass and I'd come back to it. And for an hour, the guys tap danced and both refused to discuss fees with me or, you know, they kept saying, of course you could hire us. And yeah, we can get together a fee chart. And I said, well, can't you just give us a simple, you know, and he said, no. Well, yeah, we can draw something up and we'll get it. So basically for an hour, they tap danced and refused to discuss fees or an NDA. So they're either the worst corporate salesmen in the world, or I've confirmed that, yeah, they in fact have been hired to investigate me. So that's where we are. You may think I'm nuts. First of all, you may think I'm nuts about all this. If you don't, and you about the shorting, the naked shorting, all this stuff, if you want to get your paper certificates, this is how you do it. First, you call your broker. And if you're like most people, you're going to call your broker, and your broker will say, oh, it was going to take me 6 to 8 weeks to get your paper certificates. And you're going to have to pay $25, and they're going to do everything they can to stall you. And because, that's what they're going to do. So if that happens, send a registered letter to them, talk to their compliance officer, send it to them. And I've heard stories now of people stretching this out 6 months or a year. So send the compliance officer a registered letter, and if you don't get a good answer, report it to your state regulator, securities regulator. And or, you can contact this woman. She's our transfer agent, Therese Collins. I have not warned her, so I suspect she's going to get to lose the calls. This is her call, her telephone number and her fax number. If you believe the stuff I'm saying is a problem, and that there, you know, if you think the stuff I'm saying is a problem, and you think that there is some risk, some settlement risk, and you know, at the end of the day, there's going to be people that have paper and them that don't. And those that have paper are going to get it by probably calling this transfer agent or sending her a fax and demanding it in paper. Now, I got my paper when we did the stock buy-in. I got our paper in 2 days. And I had insisted before we did the buy-in that I was only going to accept paper. I'm just not believing in the system anymore. And so try it with your broker. If you don't get any love there, talk to your state regulator. It's very simple. If you need my help, I know a bunch of them at this point, and you can fax this woman and demand your search in paper. If you think I'm nuts about all this, just ignore me. Don't do anything about it. I suspect that what I've had to say is going to make I suspect there's some unhappy people at this point. There are not chairs to cover. There's a lawsuit filed. There are state regulators who've taken a very active interest in this. And maybe even there are other feds than the SEC who are turning into a willing audience. I don't know. But I think there are going to be some people unhappy with what I've said. So if you have a problem with it, first of all, as I said, I'm getting out of the game of talking about this stuff, discussing it, anything. A lot of people call me with tips and information and they want to talk. If you're another company in the same situation, call Brent Baker or Mark Griffin at the numbers I put up there. Now, Brent is a 14-year SEC guy who just retired a few months ago and is a specialist in abusive shorting. Mark Griffin, so every state, you know, has its own SEC. Mark Griffin was the head of the SEC, so to speak, of Nevada and then of Utah, and then the head of the group of SEC, of state chairmen called the North American State Security Administrators Association. If there's other folks who don't like what I've said and have a problem with it, just call my longtime friend and lawyer, Tullis Wells, Bracewell Giuliani. Tullis has been my lawyer for about 10 years. And if you've got a beef with what I've said, call call him over at Graceville Giuliani. They've got what you need. Now, as of yesterday, or the day before, actually, I did not have time to amend this slide. I have a new set of lawyers, led by John O'Quinn and Wes Christian and Adam Boyle. Now, this is a funny group from Texas. Good guys. Nice big. I like these guys. They're sort of guys out of a John Grisham novel. Real smart. O'Quinn's a great big strapping Texas cowboy. He sued Texas. He sued Big Tobacco on behalf of Texas and won $17 billion, pocketed a couple of it himself. And now he just funds lawsuits that he thinks has a social purpose. And we met, it was like two lost, you know, brothers meeting, because we've come from very different directions to the same conclusion. That this stuff I'm talking about represents a real threat in America. It's a threat to entrepreneurs. It's a threat to mainstream America. We've got, I think, a group of parasites who have found a loophole that they can keep on using to just drain resources out of entrepreneurs in America, and in the process killing small companies. I think we just got lucky. I think they were fishing on a pier, and they hooked a nuclear submarine as it went flying by with us. But other companies aren't so lucky. And how I really feel is like I walked down an alley, and a bunch of thugs tried to roll me, and have managed to fend them off so far and basically get away. But I look back, and there's a dozen other folks, you know, strewn on the ground who've been rolled by these guys. And it's just not in my blood to say, oh, well, I'm lucky, I'm going to walk away. You can't do that. You've got to do something. I mean, we were the lucky ones, but we've got to do something about the other folks who are coming down the alley. Now, because this is my last time talking about it, I'm going to answer a few questions that I know are challenges people are going to make. One is, why not take it to the authorities? Well, you know, to that, I say the SEC, come on, look at the graph of the miscreants ball and tell me the SEC is up to taking something like that on. They're up to going after Martha Stewart on a good day. They're not up to taking it on a web like that. They probably are afraid it might cause volatility. But they're not the only game in town. As I said, there are state and federal folks who are getting, I think, or have become quite interested in these hedge fund matters, albeit from different directions. Now, take the Elgindy case. Did you know, and you can find this on the Internet, that Elgindy, who was this guy who was paying off folks for federal agents for inside information, Elgindy liquidated his stock portfolio on September 10, 2001, his stock portfolio for himself and his children. Start digging into the hedge funds, and you start coming across some very strange things going on. You know who reads O'Brien's log? You can tell from the IPs, and they don't pass their IPs. Folks from the SEC read it, of course, and I can understand that. But also a bunch of folks come from Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates to read what's going on in this movement. So now I return to the question with which I opened. I truly do know that short sellers, that CEOs who care about short sellers are generally crooks or egomaniacs, or they're pride-driven, or all these things that I, of which I get accused, or fools, which I'm sure I get accused. And I agree that under normal circumstances, it is a fool's errand to try to do anything about this, to wrangle with them. But I've come to suspect that this party line advice is actually just part of the ideology that they promulgate. They want CEOs, they want to do this stuff and have ask CEOs to lay back and think of England as they get rolled. So I ask you, dear listener, to consider that. I mean, with Kroll investigating me, with people trying to get the SEC to come after me, with folks trying to get the Justice Department to believe that I'm involved in money laundering, criminal, while David Rocker pays Camelback to publish whatever he supplies them, as long as they hold it long enough for him to build his position, et cetera, et cetera. Is it really the smart thing they've done? Just said, oh no, I'm just going to sit on my hands and keep taking this. Maybe it's just my black Irish, you know, temper. I'm just not cut out I can keep up making reasons of why I'm taking these guys on or why I'm taking them on. Truth is, I'm just not cut out to sit on my hands for this kind of stuff. So I say to Rocker, Cody's, and all the other miscreants, did I stutter? Did I stutter, or did I say I was going to take this fight to you? Well, now you know what I meant. And lastly, the man I've identified here as the Sith Lord of this stuff, I say, you know who you are, and I hope that this is worth it, because if the feds catch you again, this time they're going to bury you under the prison, and I'm going to enjoy helping them. Well, at the very least, I hope that the listener can understand why I've taken this admittedly unusual step. I don't plan on being in this job for the rest of my life. And while I'm in it, I want to do it my way. As I said, I am now handing the baton to more capable, lordly hands. Thank you.